Welcome everybody here on a Wednesday morning. We've got a full agenda here today. My purpose today is to move as quickly as we can through these public hearings, so I'll ask everyone to be as concise in their testimony as we possibly can so we get through the agenda. We won't be going into work session, of course, on any bills today. We're mostly interested in just getting a temperature of the water on some issues, possibly for further consideration as we move forward in the session. With that said, as a general request, let me open a public hearing on what looks like a lot of interest here. House Bill 2804. Open a public hearing on that. Vic Yates, if you want to give us your quick summary of that, and then we've got Representative Butler and Senator Morissette and our own Representative Williams to speak to us.
Mr. Chair, members, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. You should have three pages that I prepared in connection with this bill. First is the staff measure summary, which says that the bill essentially increases the tax rate on malt beverage and cider by $33.07 per barrel, which is almost exactly 10 cents per 12-ounce can. Effective January 1, 2004, transfers the revenue from increased rates to a new county health fund and appropriates money to the Department of Administrative Services for distribution to the counties, distributes 10% equally and 90% in proportion to county population, establishes the county health fund, and essentially takes effect on January 1, 2004. The second page shows the revenue impact. Would raise $110.7 million in the first year because it's only in effect for about 18 months, first biennium, and then about $160 million in the subsequent bienniums. And I also showed a distribution there by county. The bill says based on population, doesn't say what population. I used census population April 1, 2000. I would assume DAS would adopt by rule what population estimates they want to use.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's bring up our trio here of members, Representative Williams, Representative Butler, and Senator Morissette. Let's see. I know we've seen these two all the time. Senator Morissette, I don't think we've had you in the revenue this session, have we?
Yeah.
Welcome. Okay. Who's first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. Thank you very much for the opportunity to bring to you this particular House bill this morning. I continue to wear a cap that says, beef, it's what's for dinner. I hope that we'll be able to resolve the issues for bringing jobs to rural Oregon pretty soon because this rascal's grown to the top of my head and I need to get it off. Colleagues, my litmus test for public service is and always has been, will what you're doing strengthen families? And that's the bottom line for me. And so it's with that in mind that for some time I have been anxious about the cost of alcohol consumption, particularly beer, amongst the youth in Oregon and overall with regard to its commensurate cost to us as a society. And I just want to make three specific points relative to this particular proposal that I'm bringing to you today. I'd first tell you that I believe that the public is better informed about SARS, that sudden acute respiratory syndrome, than we are about our own underage drinking problem in Oregon. And number two, beer is the drink of choice of offending minors seeking to act out with alcohol in Oregon. And finally, number three, higher-priced alcohol has some small effect on how, where, and whether youngsters will choose to consume beer. But ultimately, it's not raising a tax that may be significant, but how we would discipline ourselves to utilize those resources to address the costs, the true costs to Oregon's economy and youth in the consumption and the illegal consumption of alcoholic beverages. And so with that, colleagues, this Mr. Yates has done an excellent job in describing exactly what this bill does and how much is anticipated maybe raised. And I would certainly defer to the work groups with which we've been working to be able to utilize those proceeds to address that towards the community partnerships that address the actual getting the water to the end of the row. That's important to me as a farm community, is getting the water to the end of the row. And colleagues, I'm very concerned that that doesn't happen when we invest huge amounts of resources and money here on Capitol Mall. We've heard again this week that of 96,002 square miles in Oregon, the Capitol Mile is 2 miles surrounded by 96,000 square miles of reality. We've got to have a reality check to make sure that we get the water to the end of the row and make sure that we address Oregon's underage drinking problems and the other related costs to society in Oregon of a consumption of all alcoholic beverages, but particularly making certain that each of the alcoholic beverages, relative to the tax that it raises, addresses the issues that we're trying to address as we try and resolve some of the issues that we're faced with. With that, I'd be happy to turn the microphone over to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Senator Morissette. For the record, Max Williams, State Representative, House District 35, and I appreciate Representative Butler allowing me to make a few comments on his bill. Senator Morissette has his own bill, and I have my own bill that we have filed in this legislative session related to the beer tax. And there is a group of us who have sponsored these bills who are working together to try to come up with a comprehensive bill that we can all generally get behind and support, and I am quite heartened, I think, at the prospects of our ability to do that. I just want to put on record my support for raising the beer tax. As this committee knows, given the overviews that we've had throughout the legislative session, Oregon has one of the lowest beer taxes in the nation. And that in and of itself may not be a reason to raise it simply because it's low. What I will tell you is that I come at this issue to a great degree because of my experience in another committee in this building as the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and having watched through that process the impacts of alcohol as it relates to our criminal justice system. With less money available based on budget cuts that have been made through the special sessions and through actions of the E-Board, the elimination of essentially alcohol and drug treatment programs throughout this state, we are merely cost-shifting at a much higher price substantial numbers of individuals into a criminal justice system that can ill afford to address those issues or deal with those persons. I won't bore you with the details of the impacts of the Chief Justice's budget reduction order, the fact that the courts are closed on Friday, the fact that many jails are not holding people who are arrested for various offenses and instead letting those people back out onto the streets, people who have been assigned to parole and probation responsibilities, which include drug and alcohol treatment programs, and they can't get them. And because they can't get them, they reoffend, they violate the terms of their probation, they're pulled back into the system at a much higher cost and expense. And similarly, the same is true with mental health. And you would hear from the experts that you might get a chance to hear from later, either on this bill or one of the other bills that comes forward, the relationship between so many people who have mental health challenges and how there is a codependency on alcohol in those relationships. Without some additional revenue to go to those programs, we will pay either in the impact on victims in this state, victims of the criminal justice system, or we will pay through the criminal justice system to address a problem that is most and best addressed through access to appropriate alcohol and drug treatment programs, which will not happen if we choose not to increase this tax. I support the beer tax to the extent that the money is dedicated to alcohol and drug mental health programs that have that impact. I would not support it if we were simply going to dump it into the top of the general fund. But where there is a nexus relationship to the impacts of the very products that we're taxing in our criminal justice system, I think it behooves us, particularly because of the low rate at which we currently tax alcohol in this state, to raise that tax. the last comment I'll make, members of the committee, is I've heard the objection made regularly that if we would just capture all of the money we currently send through the formula, including that money out to local governments, and put it into A&D treatment, as opposed to let local governments operate their budgets off any amount of the current beer tax, would have more than enough for alcohol and drug treatment. And my response to that question, to that objection, is this. I sit on a city budget committee for a local government, and I know where they spend their money. And they spend their money primarily, and those of you who are in city government know this, they spend it in law enforcement. That's the primary number one expense in a city budget, is funding their law enforcement needs. And if you go out and have a conversation like I have on many occasions with the cop on the beat, what the cop on the beat will tell you is that a high percentage of the incidents of their responding to calls involve alcohol abuse, whether it's domestic relations or whether it's a DUI or a traffic accident, that there is an alcohol component to many, many, many of the calls that we ask local law enforcement to respond to. So I don't think it's inappropriate that some portion of the current revenue off the beer tax that's directed to local governments to help fund their budgets goes to those programs, because I think, again, there is an establishable nexus relationship between those expenses that local government is having to meet and the costs of the product to the community and the citizens and the victims of the state as a result of that. So that would be my response in anticipation of that likely objection that you might hear from raising this tax. I hope that this committee will remain open-minded about this issue, and I am confident that working with Senator Morissette, Representative Dingfelter, Representative Butler, myself, and Representative Steve March, that together we're going to be able to come to you with a unified proposal that would recommend both the amount. I would disagree with the amount of Representative Butler's bill. I think it's higher than it needs to be, in my personal opinion. Some people in their proposals have wine, and I would maybe make a disagreement with that. But working together, those of us who are supportive of this concept, we believe we'll be able to have a unified proposal that we could recommend together to this committee to act on this very, very important measure this session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer questions after Representative Morissette. Senator Morissette.
Mayor Morissette?
Thank you. Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm here in total support of House Bill 2804. As was mentioned, Representative Dingfelter and I have also introduced a bill. We've modified our proposal because of the meetings we've had with the stakeholders, including Representative Butler and Representative Williams and Representative March. We are no longer proposing a wine tax. We've been convinced that, first of all, it wouldn't amount to that much, and secondly, wine is somewhere in the middle of the state rankings. It's beer as in, is down at the bottom, so I think the justification for a beer tax is much more than a wine tax. I also feel that wine probably fits the economic development goals of the state better than the microbrewers. And under this tax, there would be an exemption for small microbrewers. So I think that we are making some progress. Much has been said about the need for additional money for local administration of drug, alcohol, mental health programs. We've cut many of those from state funding. There's not a prospect for that money to go back. I think it's important that we provide adequate treatment, or there will indeed be a cost shift, as has been mentioned, to jails and to hospitals. I don't think we really have a choice here. We will continue to work together to refine our proposal. I'm very hopeful that it will pass the Senate. I think we have 18 votes, and in the House side, you only need one Democrat to vote for this bill, and you guys will have 36. So I'm also very hopeful that you will get it through the House. I did call the Treasurer's office and said, what would happen if the House passed the bill, the Senate passed the bill, the governor signed the bill, and I said, could we move money up to the front end of the biennium and start funding some of these programs on July 31st. And I was told, well, there is the ability to move money around within the department. I think that would be a great opportunity to, now we would only collect 18 months, obviously, over, we wouldn't collect the full 24 months, so it would be a lesser amount. But I think my goal would be to pass this bill through the legislature, get the governor's signature, try to provide the services July 1st. There's a great deal of need out there. I'm working with the health plan group with Senator Westland and our Representative Westland and Cruz. I am chair of the Senate Policy Committee. We are struggling to save the remnants of the Oregon health plan. It's dead as we know it. We're trying to decide. We're doing a triage approach. Who do we need to save? We are not talking about the people who are below the radar screen, and there are probably 300,000 people in Oregon who are uninsurable. Many of these people are the mentally ill who rely on drugs, alcohol, or just people who rely on drugs, alcohol. I did serve on an interim task force, an OLCC task force with Senator Farioli. The result of that task force, one of the recommendations was to pass a beer tax, a beer wine tax, actually. One of the things that we looked at during that task force was the advertising by the industry and how it targets youth. Now, if you watch sports on television, you will see the kind of beer ads that I think are almost pornographic. I think they are definitely targeting youth. And I think prevention at the local level is extremely important. There are a lot of prevention techniques. We have to provide the funding for the experts to do their job at the local level, and I agree that local law enforcement also is extremely important. So now there's one thing that we are talking about that hasn't been mentioned in the other bills, and that is to try to get some matching fund for a 60-40 match for some of the money that would go into the mental health drug alcohol treatment. And that's a 60-40 match. We would gain a lot of dollars by doing that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Let me recess the public hearing on House Bill 2804. We've got Representative Crummell in the back of the room. I believe you're here on 3805.
3085.
Yeah, 3085. That's what I meant. 3085. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3085.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of gentlemen that I'd like to bring with me. Is that all right? Or and if you want to hold off on 3085 until you're done with the other.
Oh, well, we've got a few others. Well,
I can hold off. That's
all right. Well, if you don't mind. Okay, then we'll just do that. We'll finish this one up. We've got. So, that's okay. Appreciate that. Then in that case, let me recess the hearing on 3805. Did I open one on 3805? 3085? Okay, I'll recess that and return to the public hearing. Stay where you are on 2804. Let me bring up folks here in a couple of groups, and then we'll finish our testimony on this bill. Bob Wright, Gene Cowan, and Kevin Campbell. Yeah. False alarm, Elizabeth.
What?
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Wright. I'm the director of the Eastern Oregon Alcohol Foundation in Pendleton. And formerly, I served 33 years in corrections. 12 and a half years as a prison superintendent. And what I would like to share with you is that of all those thousands of people that I managed in the prison system from 1963 through 1998, 70 to 80% of those people were there with a drug or alcohol issue that contributed to their being locked up. I know that treatment works, and it's my interest that addicts and alcoholics get treatment and avoid the necessity of serving time and all those consequences of addiction. A beer tax will help assure that treatment will be available. While I'm here on behalf of the Alcohol Foundation in Pendleton, we operate a 36-bed residential treatment facility. We, in this past year, served 177 adults. 26 children resided with their parents while mom or dad were in treatment for drug and alcohol addiction and in recovery. We also operate a detox facility, and there are 357 clients that we served there in the last 18 months. Effective in February 1st, our funding was reduced by $9,000 due to the reduction of public beds. And then in that same month, we lost our corrections contract due to the Measure 28 reduction, and we've laid off 5 staff. Our waiting list, there's no end. We had been running 20 regularly, and is increased to 44 people wanting treatment, waiting to get in to treatment for drug and alcohol addiction. Treatment works. The tax would help make it possible for people that abuse the substances to contribute to the cost of treatment for those who become addicted and afflicted with the disease of alcoholism. The national data is that 5% of the beer is consumed by 5% of beer drinkers consume 42% of all the alcohol. And in Oregon, 40% of people don't drink beer at all. But we support these beer tax measures. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next? Yes.
Good morning, representatives. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today representing the Eastern Oregon Human Services Consortium. EOSH is a consortium of mental health programs for 13 Eastern Oregon counties, and I do have a bit of written testimony to distribute.
We'll get staff down there in a minute. Go ahead.
First of all, I would like to say that I'm a native Oregonian, and this last year and a half has been extremely tough on all of us Oregonians. We've been faced with choices that have been unprecedented in harm to the public of the choices that you've faced. And I applaud the way we have been dealing with the issue thus far, but I have to tell you, this state is in a spiral that I'm not proud of. From a local perspective, as a coordinator of a regional program, as a former county judge, I can tell you that the system can work much, much better than it has worked this last 2 years. But it cannot improve unless we have some new revenue into the system. What I'd like to talk to you about today is not the amount of the tax necessarily. I believe that it's the appropriate amount, but the delivery system that's proposed in 2804. We need to bring clean, matchable dollars into the bottom of the delivery system. If we do not do that, then every time there's a general fund shortfall in Salem, those of us that are out in the field trying to deliver programs lose not only that general fund, but the federal funds that accompany those dollars. If we allow that to continue to happen, then rural counties primarily will suffer first and suffer the longest. The most urban counties in the state will suffer first and will suffer the longest. And those in the middle will be on life support, which is what I feel we're on at the present time. I don't smoke cigarettes. On occasion, I do drink a beer. As a good Oregonian, I'm not going to start smoking cigarettes to help solve the problem. I don't mind at all paying an extra 10 cents for a glass of beer. Your average smoker that smokes a pack a day is paying enough taxes under the current rate that a beer drinker would have to drink 640 beers a day to pay that amount of taxes. That's by my calculations. I drive a lot, and what I do when I drive is I think about numbers. Even with this increase, and you're probably going to hear lots of testimony about how huge this increase would be, the average beer drinker would have to drink about 12 beers a day to pay the equivalent of what a smoker pays in cigarette taxes. And I will tell you that there's something we've learned in dealing with the chronically mentally ill population, in dealing with the Oregon Health Plan population, a disproportionate number of folks are smokers. They're burdened with a cigarette tax that was 60 cents. Talk about huge. It was put out to the voters and it passed. No problem. I believe with the mechanism in place and the arguments that we can make at the rural level, the local level, that funding the system from the bottom up rather than the top down is the beginnings of a new way of doing business in Oregon. Even if this measure were referred, it could pass easily. And I believe it's a chance that the Oregonians deserve to get. When I used to serve on county court, on any given Wednesday, we were faced with horrible decisions that we had to make. And we were strongly lobbied from both sides. And as Commissioner Cowan can say, when you're one of three people, at the end of the session, you get your choice. You can either be one-third of an idiot, or you can be half of an idiot, depending on which way the vote goes and who's going your way. But the difficulty is, when you go back out to your community, you know in your heart when you've made the right choice. And you know in your heart when you've made a less than right choice. It is time for Oregon to raise the beer tax. I strongly support Representative Butler and his efforts. I believe that his loyalty to counties as a former county commissioner is still apparent in this funding system. And the only thing that I would call your attention to in the chart that I've handed out is without the base, without the distribution formula as he's written it, with 10% being split equally among counties, what our counties would get would be a pittance. And you can't run a program over 46,000 square miles on a pittance. If I had my preference, of course, there'd be a square mileage component in the distribution chart. But certainly I support what he's proposed. And most emphatically, I say it needs to be an adequate amount. It needs to come into the bottom of the system at the county level with some flexibility. We need to work collaboratively to recruit federal monies to support the program to match the needs of our populations. We can do that, and this measure could begin a change that would make me very proud to continue being an Oregonian. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Cowan.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm Jean Cowan. I'm a county commissioner from Lincoln County. And I'm here this morning representing myself and also the Association of Oregon Counties. There's some written material that's been submitted from that was written by Gordon Foltz from the Association of Oregon Counties. And I'll just briefly mention a few points in that. But primarily, I'm here this morning to speak from the heart and to tell you how I feel about the issues that we're facing at the county level. The association has historically supported increases in beer and wine tax over the last 30 years. The historical perspective that Gordon has prepared for you dates back to 1973. At that time, we knew how pervasive the use of and abuse of alcohol was throughout our social service and public safety systems. That hasn't changed. It's only worsened as we work through our processes. We know that alcohol abuse affects every part of our public safety and our human services system, and you've heard some testimony to that effect today that I won't repeat. AOC was planning to update our historical support of these various measures, and I think that the conferences that are scheduled to be held that will talk about merging these three bills will undoubtedly be successful. We do, however, support the distribution of the proceeds from the tax as is proposed in House Bill 2804. You're all well aware that counties are the state's major human services partner responsible for the delivery of the critical services at the local level. And I believe we are accountable for those service deliveries. We're the ones that people call when they don't get the services that they need. And believe me, I'm taking more of those telephone calls now than I ever have before. Gordon's included some charts on the county-state relationship and some detail that I'll let you take a look at as, on your own. But basically, as the state and county revenues have plummeted over the last 12 months, the shared services that are outlined in some of those charts have been cut dramatically at the local level. I, too, am a native Oregonian, and I'm really struggling these days. I go home in the sort of the depths of depression because of the kind of conversations we're having on a daily basis. At home in Lincoln County, we're losing our ability to provide services. We've lost a big portion of our alcohol and drug residential treatment efforts that people have worked on so hard over the years. Those staff have already been cut. We're seeing major problems with our prevention programs, and we know that we need to reach out to people early, and particularly young people, to stop this cycle. I go to some graduation ceremonies every so often in the jail as inmates graduate from what's called the SAIL program. I believe that stands for Successful Achievements in Living. Here I hear powerful testimony from those individuals standing up there in tears, telling all of us about the changes that these programs have made in their lives, that for the first time they're actually understanding that they have choices that they can make about their behaviors. And I believe that those individuals are very sincere when they say, I'm leaving here and I'm not going back into this cycle. I heard a presentation from an individual who's now a chef at one of our local restaurants about how he did come through the program and has made something, but how difficult it was when he got on the outside. If we don't have some of those follow-up programs to help some of these individuals with their resolve to stay away from alcohol, which, as we've already heard, is probably the predominant factor that got folks there in the first place, because many of the crimes that are committed are under the influence of some sort. If we don't have some of those follow-up programs, we're not going to be as successful as we could be. I think that connectivity to all of the law enforcement issues that we're facing, to our mental health treatment programs, to all of those challenges at the local level are extremely important. At home, though, I just go from one meeting to the next. I talk to the public safety people about the cuts, the courts, we won't be able to hold offenders accountable because we're losing our parole and probation people. And then I move on over to a health and human services meeting where we talk about the reductions that we're making in prevention and in treatment services. It's just the cycle that we're in right now, and that's very, very difficult. So the fact that House Bill 2804 creates a county health fund and distributes those funds to counties primarily for alcohol and drug abuse prevention, early intervention, and treatment services, that means a lot to me. AOC supports the distribution formula. Again, some of the information you have will go through the various distributions, and I'm not going to bore you with the numbers right now. But in 1973, alcohol and drug treatment services were good, but they weren't nearly as effective as they are today. And we know that those services make a difference and that we can make a difference at the local level if we have the ability and the assistance from the state and from the folks who are consuming the beverages to help us put together those programs. So the bottom line is that we support this bill and the others that seek to increase the tax. As in 1973, we look forward to working with you with your committee on this very important issue, and I appreciate you taking time to listen to us today.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these witnesses? All right. Thank you. We're going forward. Madeline Olson, let's bring you up from DHS.
Good morning. I'm Madeline Olson, the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2804. You've heard what influence it will have on revenues in the coming biennium, and with the bill as written, at least half of those revenues would be used for alcohol and drug abuse prevention and treatment. That would be roughly $55 million and would allow the restoration of the non-Oregon health plan cuts that have been made this current biennium. These revenues would make it possible to avoid further reductions in services in the coming biennium and would make it possible to match federal Medicaid funds under certain circumstances and restore or continue funding for Medicaid-eligible people. The bill itself doesn't specify the apportionment of the funds between mental health and public health, But again, if it were half of the remaining half, it would help restore all of the services that have been cut from mental health for non-OHP-covered people this biennium. And in the last 5 months, that's been about $15 million. So it would make a substantial difference in the restoration of treatment to the very poor in our state who suffer from major mental illnesses. Again, this bill also allows for the possibility of funding public health services, and the state... This would allow both state and local health departments to improve the ability of local health clinics to respond to diseases and conditions, both reportable and chronic, for example, hepatitis C, direct observed therapy for tuberculosis, influenza immunization clinics. Mm-hmm. Again, this bill and the revenues it generates would greatly improve the health of our communities and our children and families. As you've heard from a number of people this morning, these services have an incredible influence on the health of families and the health of local communities. As you're considering the merits of this bill, I would like you to include in your consideration the usefulness in our local communities of maintaining or restoring the safety net services for people with mental illnesses, people with substance abuse disorders, and people that rely on our public health clinics. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Questions? All right, thank you for coming down today. We have two more panels here. We have Kathy Stromvig, Richard Grandoff, I think, and Pam Erickson. Let's bring you forward. Pam, you're wearing a new hat these days.
That's true.
Who wants to go first?
I can go home. Okay. I'm Pamela Erickson. I'm the director of the Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. And I've provided with you some information. It's basically an outline of the costs of alcohol to this society. It reiterates a lot of the testimony that you've already heard this morning. I do want to say a few words about the problem of underage drinking. In my view, this is this state's most serious alcohol problem. It always shocks me when I see that 1 out of 4 eighth graders reports drinking in the last month. That's truly a frightening statistic, because we now know that if a young person starts drinking before age 15, their chances of being an addict as an adult are 4 times greater than if they waited until they were 21. So all of these treatment facilities will be truly overwhelmed if we don't get a handle on underage drinking. We have supported an increase in the beer tax for a very long time for a variety of reasons. One is that beer is the beverage of choice for the underage drinker, far greater than any other kind of product. And if you'll turn to the last 2 pages, you'll see that in terms of revenue, alcohol revenue to the state, beer just isn't paying its fair share. If you look at the amount of revenue generated through taxes and the markup on distilled spirits, you see that only a small amount is generated from beer. And yet the next page shows you that in terms of consumption of alcohol products, beer far exceeds any other product. So simply in terms of fairness, we believe that the tax should be increased. It's long overdue, and we urge that the committee consider that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. Thank you. My name is Kathy Stromvig, and I currently sit on the board of the Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking, as well as the board for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm a victims advocate, as well as a victim myself of the violent crimes. I come this morning as a parent, as a grandparent, as a very concerned citizen. The whole of my life has been spent in trying to deal with the negative effects of alcohol use. I'm probably no different than a lot of other people who have had individuals in their family who have used, abused, or been negatively impacted by the use of alcohol. So I come as a concerned citizen on how we can make some change in this. It seems a lot of times all we do is after the fact. When somebody's in trouble, we deal with that issue. And so I come as a person to ask you if we could spend a little more on the prevention end to stop things before they get started. I work with high school youth. I hear a lot of stories about how their friends are drinking consistently. I work with parents who come to me and say, I've got my youth that I don't know what to do with because they're drinking. I think we can do a lot with prevention instead of always worrying about the other end, but I know we have to work together on prevention, on treatment, on safety issues. And I also want to say that I commend our lawmakers who are coming together on this issue, finally. That's really great. I also know that beer is a drug of choice for teenagers. They don't go out and get wine or get distilled spirits. So we need to do something about making beer less acceptable to youth or accessible to youth. And by raising the price, we'll do this. We need to help parents to help them in some way so that their kids won't be constantly accessing this. So by raising a beer, 10 cents a drink, I think it's going to make a difference, and I hope that you will take a good, long, hard look at this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Drandoff.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Richard Drandoff. I'm Executive Director of ChangePoint Incorporated. We provide outpatient substance abuse treatment services in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, and we have the contract to serve the Spanish-speaking population of those counties as well. We have a large number of Spanish speakers in treatment at our agency. I'm not a native Oregonian, I'm sorry to say, but I've been working in the alcohol and drug treatment field since 1976 when I first moved here, and I saw at that point a system that was first beginning to be funded. We were kind of in the infancy of knowing what to do with substance abusers and how to treat them. We saw a system develop that became a model nationally, and I've been involved with some national organizations and research projects, and everywhere I go, people say, Oregon, wow, you have a great system. Now they say quite the opposite. What's happening there? Why have the funds been cut? Why are people no longer being treated? Don't the policymakers understand that a reduction in treatment services is going to result in people who are left untreated, more street crime, all the attendant problems that go along with that? We haven't raised the beer tax in this state since 1973. Everything else has gone up probably double or triple since that time. We do make the connection in this state between the use of tobacco and health problems, gambling and gambling problems, road taxes, and people paying for licenses to drive and people paying for car licenses to fix the roads. We charge user fees for campers in the state parks, but we don't do the same thing with beer drinkers. And I think it's time that we made that connection, that the people who are consuming, the 5% who I mentioned before, who consume 40% of the product, are the ones that are costing the society a great deal of money, and it's time that we started to make that connection and have the treatment paid for by those folks. The cost offsets for alcohol and drug treatment are anywhere from $5 to $7 saved for every dollar spent, and that's in the criminal justice system and the health care systems. And at this particular point, I think it's important to note that with the state legislature considering a parity bill for commercially insured folks, that would raise the level of benefit for alcohol and drug treatment and mental health treatment to the same level as health care treatment, that we're about to do that for the less vulnerable part of the population, while at the same time we're taking away the coverage from the most vulnerable part of the population. And I think it's a really critical thing to look at that we have a large number of uninsured folks who are going to be left without the possibility of receiving care for their substance abuse problems, while at the same time those who are lucky enough to be employed and have health insurance through their employers will be covered for those same conditions. So I would urge the committee and the legislature to look really long and hard at this bill and to give it passage, and to understand that outcomes, even though we've had some difficulties with the legislature in the past with alcohol and drug issues in terms of a good measure of outcomes, that we know that the outcomes for alcohol and drug treatment are at least equal to those of heart disease treatment, cancer treatment, other medical care. treatment works. We know that it works, but it's not going to work if we don't have the funding to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much. John Powell, Richard Costasan, and Mark Nelson, while they're coming up, let me just remark, I've got one more name added to the list here, Mary Ann Schwab. Then I'm going to cut off testimony. I really had not expected such an extended conversation on this bill this morning and hadn't built that into the schedule for the committee. So I'll not be taking any additional witnesses, but I want to make sure, since we've heard from proponents, that we give Mr. Powell, Mr. Costa, and Mr. Nelson an opportunity to be heard as well, and Ms. Schwab, because she got in on the list. But after that, we'll move on to other bills. We just got to get going here. We're under time constraints this week. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing Anheuser-Busch. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. As you, we did not expect the extensive testimony today, but we'll try to respond to some of the things that have been said. There have been a variety, as you know, a variety of different proposals put forward to increase beer and wine taxes, and as been indicated today, I think most of the direction is now towards a beer tax. Those proposals range from a 200% increase to a 1,300% increase in the beer tax. It is correct, as proponents have said, we do have one of the lowest beer taxes in the country. We are 46th in the country. That is for a reason, however. There are four states below us, and they are three of those are beer-producing states, as Oregon has become a beer-producing state. Wisconsin, Missouri, and Colorado. The fourth state is Wyoming. They just don't like beer taxes in Wyoming. The primary reason why Oregon, of course, has become a beer-producing state, even with the loss of Blitz Weinhardt, is Oregon's microbrew industry. It is the largest in the country. 10% of the sales in Oregon comes from Oregon microbrews. That might not sound like a lot, but in comparison, the nearest state in the country is Colorado at 2%. So Oregon sales are 10%, or microbrew sales are 10% of all sales in the state. There has been some discussion in terms of the direction of where this money should go. You've heard today that the primary direction has been alcohol and drug programs, as well as mental health. As I think the chair and others have heard from us, we have a concern that at the present time we raise about $100 million net dollars a year from beer, wine, and alcohol taxes. And this is a round number. We currently spend about, if you follow the path of this money, and it's fairly torturous, but if you follow that path, you will find about $12 to $13 million of that $100 million finds its way into alcohol and drug programs. Drinkers, in other words, pay $100 million a year, but the government, state, local, and city, although cities don't provide direct programs, have found that those particular alcohol and drug programs are not a priority to fund out of that $100 million, and that beer drinkers are being asked to increase their taxes that they pay for these programs that government has found, for a variety of reasons, are not priorities for their programs. In other words, we believe, and we have offered to the counties, to go and lobby Ways and Means and the body to move state general fund dollars little by little out of the general fund over the last four or five bienniums to build up alcohol and drug programs before we come back and ask Oregonians who consume those products to pay a higher tax. Representative Williams, I think, raises an issue as to whether or not dollars that have been going to cities and counties and state government and not being used for alcohol and drug programs, whether they in fact are serving the abuse of the abuser of the alcohol and drug program. Well, I think there's some merit in that argument. At the same time, if you go back to 1977 and you look at the discussion then, when there was a proposal to dedicate those funds, those taxes being taxed in 1977 for alcohol and drug programs, the counties in particular said, no, don't throw us into that briar patch. We will continue to spend dollars on those programs, but we want the flexibility and we will use these dollars for those programs. In fact, they haven't. Those dollars, like many, many dollars that have gone from this body to local government, have gone out the back door to fund other very valuable county local government programs, but programs that they have deemed are more valuable than alcohol and drug programs. And that's what's happened to that $100 million over the time as it has increased. Again, finally, Mr. Chairman, we're asking, and I think you've heard us say this before, you're asking to tax a minority of Oregonians to pay for programs that we believe all Oregonians should pay for in a broad-based approach to the problems that we're all facing in terms of funding state and local government. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Miller Brewing Company, here to testify in opposition to this measure. Mr. Chairman, members, I just want to make, I think, 3 points. One, the microbrew industry in Oregon has grown more in the last 10 years than the standard beer industry has by far, and it is the highest priced beer anybody can buy. So the argument that merely increasing the price is going to take care of alcohol abuse, I think, rests on extremely soft ground. Secondly, the single largest component in the price of beer is taxation. The federal government taxes beer at $18 a barrel. Oregon adds $2.60 per barrel to that. So you have a $20.60 per barrel, 31 gallons of beer is taxed. That is the single largest component in the price of beer, including labor. So taxes play a big role in beer. And finally, other states, while we are low in the enumeration of states, there are many states at or near or below, as Mr. Nelson has pointed out, the Oregon rate. For example, Pennsylvania is at the Oregon rate, a little less, in fact. Maryland is just above. Nevada is just above. The District of Columbia is the same as Nevada. And Massachusetts and New York are in our range. So Oregon, while our tax is low, there's a very good reason for it. And some members who have preceded you in this body think that regressive taxation is not good public policy. And you are, in fact, taxing not only a minority of people, but when it comes to products like beer, you're taxing even a slimmer minority. And a minority of people that study after study would indicate have very modest incomes. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Let's take testimony from Mr. Kosasan, then we'll see if there's questions at the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosasan, Coors Brewing Company.
Richard, if you could pull the microphone over there. Thanks.
Richard Kosasan, Coors Brewing Company. Concur with the comments from Mr. Nelson and Mr. Powell. A couple of minor points very briefly, Mr. Chair. One of the speakers originally this morning indicated that a task force that worked during the past interim had supported a beer tax increase. I don't think that is, or I don't believe that paints an entirely accurate picture. It was not a full vote of the task force members present, and there was some discussion after the action in terms of what the final action actually meant on behalf of the task force. It seems as though we are looking at a dollar figure of $100 million or $110 million, and we're not putting it in perspective. If we took the existing tax rate in the state of Oregon and increased it 500%, we would probably generate somewhere in the neighborhood of about $30 million a year. The dime a drink represents a tax increase to Oregonians of 12 to 1300%. I think that's rather excessive. In terms of the previous speakers, too, one argument that we hear consistently is Oregon's low in terms of a national average. Well, we can take a look at other taxes that we have in Oregon and other taxes Oregonians pay, and they are substantially higher than the national average. So that logic would tell me that if we're lower in one and we want to raise it to a national average, we should also argue that we should take high taxes and lower those to the national average. I don't think that's the direction we're headed. With that, Mr. Chair,
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for any of these witnesses? All right. Thank you for coming forward on short notice. Mary Ann Schwab, we'll finish with your testimony here on House Bill 2804.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mary Ann Schwab, and I am the current delegate from the Sunnyside Neighborhood Association, Portland, Oregon, to the Governor's Oregon Liquor Control Roundtable. The last gentleman who spoke, I'd like to address something he'd said. I was there for that vote on February 15th. People did walk out prior to the vote because they chose not to vote, but it was a fair vote, but they did follow process. Two people from the industry voted to increase the beer tax. The first roundtable I attended, I learned from Nina Robert, a former director of the Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. She had gone to them and asked for a 5-cent increase. After listening to her presentation, I was shocked to learn it was 3/4 of a penny since 1977. Think about it. Elvis Presley was doing his thing, Jimmy Carter was doing his, and the Star Wars was the film of the year. This has been frozen for 26 years. And I believe that 1,000% of nothing, 13% of nothing, is nothing. When you look at 3/4 of a penny, the consumers in this state, the people that abuse this product, bring $6.5 million to the coffers. If we raised it to a dime, that would be $120 million. But with all of this taffy pull for the treatment and recovery, treatment, recovery, treatment, recovery, these are businesses. This is their livelihood. If people don't come in the front door, they lose their business. You've got the law enforcement piece. Mothers Against Driving is very concerned with the law enforcement piece. As a school secretary, I retired after 24 years working in high schools in Portland. I know what alcohol does to families. I know what alcohol does to teenagers. I've held newborns that girls went out on a date and came home pregnant. What is that damage deposit? Who's paying for that child being raised in poverty? Where is the domestic violence piece, the child abuse piece, the DUI pieces? That's your law enforcement. Let's get back to prevention. It's not funny to watch a third or fourth grader drink beer at a family picnic or to sit there and stay silent as a young woman pregnant is drinking alcohol because infant alcohol syndrome is real. I believe it's time for a dime because I want you to know that 10 cents a drink could provide more than 80 million, if not 120 million. Remember, we've got this play with figures here. Statistics can be very sadistic. You can do anything with figures. We hear it all the time. So if we really care about this and target your substance abuse prevention, your treatment recovery, and law enforcement programs, $900 million of your state dollars are paid into the human services each year because of other drug problems. I believe it's time the beer industry pays its fair share to the social and economic cost of its product. Just like the gasoline tax, you mentioned cigarettes here briefly. We drive a car, we go, we put gas in our car, we pay the tax. It goes for road repair, it goes for bridge repair, but we won't talk about the triple trailers now. But that is a consumer cost. If you use it, you pay the price rather than all the non-drinkers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2804. Representative Crummell, are you still with us? Would you please? Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3085. Elizabeth, that means it's time for you.
That's a nice touch to look at.
Come on up.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with House Bill 3085, what this bill does is it creates a tax credit for employers who provide financial assistance for an employee to purchase a home. It specifies that the financial assistance can be in the form of closing costs, interest rate buy-downs, earnest money deposits, down payment assistance, or other costs related to the purchase transaction. It's going to restrict the credit to equal the actual cost of the financial assistance paid to the employee up to $50,000 per taxpayer, or the tax liability of the taxpayer for that tax year. It limits the total amount of personal and corporate income tax credits to $15 million for the program per year. It limits the amount of the credit per employee to $10,000 who utilize then that home purchase assistance program. It requires the taxpayer to apply to the Department of Revenue for certification of the tax credit. Then it outlines the procedures that the Department of Revenue will take in issuing those tax credit certificates. It allows the credit to be carried forward 3 years, and the credit is taken in lieu of any deduction that is allowed for this expense. So if there is a deduction that's taken for this expense at the federal level, then the credit amount must be added back to Oregon taxable income. It applies to costs actually paid for home purchases assistance in tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2008, and has a sunset before January 1st, 2009.
All right. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Crummell. I'm state representative from House District 26. Mr. Chair, I introduced House Bill 3085. This is the second time around for this bill. Actually, I had introduced the same legislation in the 01 session, and it didn't seem to grow any legs. But the purpose of this is to try to spur home development, and as a former mayor, I understand the importance of home ownership in a community and what it does for a community, because it enables people to take a stake in how their community operates and what it really does. And this is a bill to try to encourage home ownership and allow employers that would like to be able to help their employees become homeowners, it would give them a means to be able to do so. I have with me, and I'm going to keep my comments very brief. Matter of fact, that's the end of my comments, Mr. Chair, because I would rather turn this over to a fellow that brought this idea to me in the first place, and his name is Dick Anderson. Dick is with Fannie Mae in Portland, and he and I had talked about this idea way back in 2000, and then in 01 when we introduced the legislation, and then again during the previous interim, or the last interim. And so I would like to allow him the time to visit with you about this bill and the importance of it. And he also has with him Kevin Montgomery Smith from the Portland Business Alliance. And I think that they view this as being a very positive business step, and one that we actually could potentially turn into a economic development tool for the state to be able to utilize. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to excuse myself for an appointment that I have, if that's all right with you. And I would like to turn it over to Dick and Kevin, and then anyone else that wishes to testify.
All right. Thank you for your
patience. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've passed out some information. I apologize for the bright colors. I understand it's inappropriate today being University of Oregon Day, but I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, I'm Dick Anderson. I'm representing today a company called Fannie Mae. We're a New York Stock Exchange company, the largest non-bank financial service company in the world. Fannie Mae operates pursuant to a federal charter and is the nation's largest source of financing for home mortgages. We don't actually make loans. We buy the loans from the local lenders. In Oregon, our investment in the mortgage portfolio is over $27 billion. So we definitely have a stake in housing in Oregon. I'm also representing a trade association called the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. That's comprised of lenders who actually make the loans on real estate in Oregon, residential, multifamily, and income-producing real estate. Fannie Mae and the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association strongly support housing. We also understand the budget crisis this state is in and your efforts to come to grips with balancing the budget. We recognize reality for House Bill 3085, along with many others, is that it may not move through the process because of a lack of revenue generation. However, I appreciate this public hearing and would ask you to think about the economic benefits of housing, specifically home ownership. This bill may be an opportunity for you to return dollars to the state budget in non-traditional ways. The Oregon economy has certainly been bolstered the last 3 years with the housing industry, one of the few bright spots in this Oregon economy. As active as our industry has been, aided by record low mortgage rates, Oregon's home ownership rate still lags the nation. Oregon is a 64% home ownership rate. Nationally, we're at 66. When you dig down into ethnic groups, in Oregon, the Hispanic and African American community has a 37% home ownership rate, while the nation is at 46. The white population enjoys a home ownership rate of 66%. Nationally, it's 72%. Oregon is definitely lagging. Any mayor of a city in Oregon will tell you that a key ingredient to a healthy community is the rate of home ownership. Studies have concluded that home ownership provides stability. Stability increases school performance for children. I've included an article in your brochure on that. Homeowners are more involved in their communities. They vote. They pay taxes. There is less crime in neighborhoods made up of homeowners. Equity in homes provides opportunity to leverage for other expenditures, such as college education for children. Equity in home accounts for the largest asset accumulation for retirement. Home ownership is definitely a wealth builder. The tax credit proposed in House Bill 3085 encourages the business community of Oregon to participate in housing, specifically home ownership. Our surveys indicate that the biggest barrier to home ownership is the accumulation of down payment and closing costs. This tax credit would encourage the business community to participate with their employees in breaking through this barrier. Public dollars for housing, which are so ever cherished today, typically go to Oregon families below the 80% median income. Working families over this figure are not eligible for public assistance and yet can't afford the median-priced home in our Oregon communities. Again, I've provided a chart showing different communities' median income and the median sales price. That's a gap. There already exists in Oregon, and specifically in Portland area, some employers that have done employer-assisted housing programs on their own, such companies as Vocker Siltronics, Emanuel Hospital, Rejuvenation, out in the suburbs, Anthro Corporation, or Blazin' and Blazin' Lumber Company, and others. These businesses should be commended for stepping forward. Their workforce and their communities have been enriched. An effective employer-assisted housing program, besides providing home ownership opportunities, can reduce employee-employer costs of commuting. It can increase the tax base for a community, provide taxable income for businesses such as realtors, home builders, and yes, mortgage lenders. Employer-assisted housing programs can stabilize a neighborhood or be used to as a revitalization tool. Public dollars for housing is an all-time low, yet the desire for home ownership is at an all-time high. This is a way to leverage dollars. What a great public-private partnership. Food, shelter, clothing, basic essentials. As a state, we already provide tax credits to encourage other activities, such as saving energy, educating the workforce, establishing educational scholarships, or contributing to individual development accounts. Home ownership is a basic element. It seems only fitting that home ownership should be encouraged so that education, productivity, less energy used, less commuter travel, etc., can be realized. Other states that I'm aware of with state tax credits for homeownership are Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois. As an employer, if an employer doesn't establish a program that is utilized by its employees, then there is no tax taken. I recommend your positive consideration of House Bill 3085. Thank you for your time and your ear. And stand ready for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Let's hear from Mr. Montgomery Smith, and then we'll open it up for questions for the two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to testify. I've really come in support, and there's not a lot that I can add to what Mr. Anderson said. It was Dick that came to the Portland Business Alliance when I first came to town almost 2 years ago to talk about employer-assisted housing, and it was interesting because I administered a program back east, and we ran into the same problems. It is wonderful that there are companies that are utilizing employer-assisted housing programs without a state tax credit, because currently there are negative tax implications if you do, and generally speaking, you have to gross up an employee because the EAH program is a taxable benefit. So if you give that benefit to an employee, you're going to be paying taxes on it as a company, and they are going to be paying taxes on it as additional income. We see the tax credit idea for employer-assisted housing as kind of neutralizing that, and where we have possibly 8 or 9, I think Dick read off, that are currently involved in housing actively as a corporation, you could be asking for, you could be looking at possibly 20, 25, you know, 30, 100. How many corporations or companies would it take to show the kind of positive return on investment that the state would be looking for? I think the $15 million goal is a modest program cost when you look at the return on investment. If you look at national home builder numbers that the national home builders provided as far as home ownership is concerned, 3,000 down payment programs could be done with the $15 million. And if you looked at the 3,000 new homeowners, they would generate more than $36 million in state and local taxes, inject nearly $530 million into the local economy and induced economic development, and combining both construction-related and ongoing employment, create more than 9,000 jobs, generate even more state and local resources. Given the very limited city, state, and federal resources available to support home ownership and also job creation, it would seem as if this would be a logical step, modest administration cost, to looking at home ownership as an economic development tool. Just because there's only four of us testifying on this as opposed to 20 or so on the last issue, I would hope that you would assume that everybody is in favor of this and you should just march forward.
Well, actually, we count numbers against, and there's no one against. So. Well, I shouldn't say that. The Revenue Coalition just did a drive-by up here.
This is desired corporate activity. This is getting business to do what you want. You want them in the housing field, and it would also take off some of the burden that state programs are feeling. And it's self-regulated. And the interesting thing about an employer-assisted housing program is that it kind of flows with the job market. When you have a tight job market and employers are using employer-assisted housing as a recruitment or a retention tool, then you see a lot of activity. When there's a soft job market, you're not going to see that much of an activity. So it's not going to have the kind of impact on state revenue that something else might. So it's a tax credit program, desired corporate action, and again, small administrative cost and self-regulated by the job market itself. And I can say from a position of being in the Portland Business Alliance, we have several companies who have found it incredibly interesting until we get to the economic impact and the negative tax implications once you do utilize the program. So, again, we would hope that you would support this bill and see it on through.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's catch Director Repine while he's up here.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Getting all my good friends, we're going to be sitting up here, and so we haven't had a chance to dialogue about the bill, so if you see me cringe if Mr. Anderson kicks me under the table, it's something that wasn't scripted. I'm here to support the bill that's in front of you today. I was asked by Senator Starr to review it a couple days ago because of his interest in it, and asked to come and make some comments about it. As both the witnesses and the sponsor of the bill had indicated, housing historically in this nation and in the state has always been a very strong piece of the economic recovery or sustainability of the economies of all states. It can be, once again, in Oregon, to be a very strong influence on how Oregon does recover and how quickly it will recover. I also am not advocating, knowing that the, currently in the budget situation that there is no $15 million located for this. I'm not advocating that I would tell you where you'd find the $15 million, so I'm declaring that.
Housing trust fund.
Yeah, it's almost the same amount, isn't it? It's a small world, isn't it? So I'm putting that disclaimer out there that I'm not advocating to the extent that I'm going to ask you to, you're going to ask me to figure out where I'm going to find the money for you. A couple of items that I'd like to mention about the bill. This has, as been mentioned earlier by Mr. Anderson, has been done effectively by some companies in the Portland area. I think the interesting part about the way some of the companies, now I can't say for all of them, but we have been tracking some of those companies, they have been able to do this with giving another incentive, and the incentive is a piece that deals also with another issue that's huge in the state of Oregon, is transportation, or the conflict that takes place between jobs and housing. And so many times we have the jobs in one county and then the housing's over here, and we seem to be moving populations in the morning to the other counties, and then in the night we go back to where we, the county we started out in. So if there's a way to encourage people to find residency relative to their jobs, and that's not always the case, but in some cases it is, I mean, this is a great tool. Some of those companies have been using this as a targeting process. In other words, they will give a down payment assistance based on their geographical relationship to the company. And so that's a way that many of them have been able to create that culture within their own companies by having them close to the proximity of the business, which is good for the business, good for the employee, because they're not spending 40 minutes to an hour and a half traveling, which is puts them in a better frame of mind. It also deals with the more of the indirect things, like if there's a crisis at home or a sick child, they're not having to travel these immense distances to deal with family issues. So as you think about these type of this bill, there are examples in the current marketplace where they use these type of incentives to help with targeting, and so that's something you might possibly consider in this bill. Again, not speaking against the bill. I think the bill is great. If we could do more of it, it would be wonderful. I think the other part that I commented to Senator Starr, and I would let the committee know, is that the way I read the bill, it really is an all-comers bill. It really does not income test it relative to the population. And that's not to say that I can give you examples of income, and affordable housing is all relative to what you do and how much money you make. So and sometimes people who make a lot of money are not able to buy the house they want because it's just out of their price range. But clearly in Oregon, I think the issues that Mr. Anderson was talking about, the number of Oregonians that own houses or don't own houses, is really a significant piece of the income difference that exists in the economies of Oregon and the employees of Oregon. So we might want, in our program, we have historically, we have a first-time homebuyer program that is run through the state of Oregon that's participated by Mr. Anderson and Fannie Mae. Our income test for that program the statutes allow us to deliver to Oregonians is currently at $56,000 in the statewide, but in targeted areas such as Multnomah County and Benton County, it's $65,000 are the income threshold. So they were just recently raised, and so they are up there to a bit more commensurative income. So it does, you know, you're not talking about somebody that's making $20,000, but you're not talking about somebody that's making $100,000. So we in the state, using our first-time homebuyer program, have tried to target an income level. So you might want to look at some income test or income level for a program like this, because I think it's important to try to get those resources to the people who are least likely to have that extra down payment, because that's what this is really all about, making them make that down payment. We use a variety of programs as a state agency working on housing where we do down payment assistance, a very small amount. We do this with partnership with the mortgage companies and the bankers. Effectively, they run programs that are called the ABCs of home buying. It's a training program that is certified by our agency. It's part of the requirements to be using our first-time home buyer program. Now, you might sit there and think to yourself, well, why would anybody want to go to school to learn about it? In today's environment, of many of the people who are not engaged in home ownership, they've never come from a culture or a family background that ever would tell them how to have been a homeowner. They have lived either in a rental situation or a situation that has deprived them of the opportunity of what does it mean to be a homeowner. So the program is not a overtaxing program, but it does give people just the basic essentials of It's important to keep a balanced checkbook. It's important that you make your mortgage payments. It's important that you don't overcredit yourself on other things that would put your risk of your home of ownership going to be at fault. So we in our programs offer a home lending program. That's something else that, you know, this may or may not be something you might adaptable to, but we find it's very important because we limit or minimize the number of people who default, because you can get into home ownership, but if you don't understand what you can do after you've gotten there, there's a higher risk of defaulting in the person. And the last thing you want to do is have somebody default in this environment. Mr. Anderson also, I think, mentioned that the state currently, and through my agency, we offer programs called IDAs, Individual Development Accounts. These are monies that are made available, a small amount of money of tax credits, I think $700,000 last biennium, that we've sold to businesses who are willing to put up money when people join an IDA account or individual development account, they are allowed to set money aside for the purpose of education, cottage industry or jobs at home industries, or housing. So either any one of those three declarations of use of that money makes them eligible to set money aside and also leverage money from these credits and other communities, such as in the metropolitan area. They have a very aggressive IDA program where they leverage as much as $4 to every $1 that a person puts up. The whole idea behind that is it gets the person's to more money for that down payment quicker, as opposed to trying to do it a dollar at a time. So you have some of those programs out there. Currently, in our first-time homebuyer program, we loan or make loans to about 1,500 to 1,400 homes every year. And I told you what the income levels are. We see the relationship of housing and business and the economy is very strong. The other part I do not want to lose sight of is it was mentioned this is new construction. Mr. Smith mentioned the numbers from the National Home Builders on if you build a house and it leverages so many dollars. That is true, and I think that's a great economic engine. I think the other piece is that there's also a huge amount of standing inventory of housing that's for sale that's already been constructed. Now, it doesn't leverage the same kind of job ratios that a new constructed house would, but it does leverage an amazing amount of equity value to a community. If you start just building new houses and having people move out, then all of a sudden your core or your community or infrastructure starts to deteriorate. And it's important to make those houses in the inner cities and other communities, the current downtown housing or the core housing, is viable for purchasing so people, next generations will move into there, not just abandon them. Because even though they don't bring the same kind of economic dollars to the community, they do save an amazing amount of money because they're not taxing on new infrastructure costs, such as police, fire, and road systems and things of that nature, because they've already been paid for first by the first house owner that was there. So again, new, used, great investments. Historically, the United States, it shows that housing is a stable commodity to be investing for economic reasons. We like this bill. Just wanted to throw a couple ideas out there how you might want to look at it to fit some of the current tools that are in place in the state of Oregon.
All right. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for any of these witnesses? Good testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hess.
Actually, just one quick comment. I thank the gentleman for the testimony, and this is, I think, a laudable idea. And one way we could afford it would be to limit the subtractions and the deductions we have for subsidies of second homes, with the policy justification being we shouldn't be subsidizing people who borrow money to buy their second home until we start helping people or businesses get people into their first home.
Thank you. All right. Anything else? Thank you very much. Committee, you have been we have been distributed written testimony from the Revenue Coalition. We'll take a minute to look at that. Okay. and with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3085. Would you please see if Representative Worth is available? And Paul, I understand that we had 2819 also on the calendar for Friday. So Representative Crummell said he would, what? Yeah. I'm gonna tap that in right now, open a public hearing on House Bill 2819, close that, and we'll revisit that on Friday. And then let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3495. Is that you?
Yeah.
Elizabeth,
yeah.
Take it away.
Okay. Representative Shutterly, Chairman Shutterly, and committee members, with House Bill 3495, this is it. You know, once you start seeing the thick bills, you know that that's a tax reform bill. So this is the first of your thick bills, and it's the tax reform bill. It's Representative Wirth. So the components in this tax reform bill is it's reducing the bottom two personal income tax rates to 4% and 6%. It applies to tax years January 1st, 2004. It allows a sales tax then to be put in place, and it allows a sales tax refund, which is going to depend on the number of household members that are low income, and then it also phases out this household phases out the sales tax refund with household incomes that beginning at $17,000. It's requiring then taxpayers to apply for these refunds with the Department of Revenue. It's specifying that non-residents must meet the income requirements of Oregon residents as well as have receipts and other records of sales or use taxes in order to get this sales tax refund. And applies to claims for sales tax paid beginning January 1st, 2004. Another component of this bill is that beginning in the 2005 biennium, it is requiring that the legislature appropriate out of the general fund for public safety and transportation at least an amount appropriated for the 2001-03 biennium for the public safety and transportation purposes. It specifies that DAS will report the amount that was appropriated for the 2001 biennium. Now, in terms of the sales tax, it's establishing a retail sales tax. It doesn't have a particular rate in there. There's a blank in there for the actual rate. It provides definitions then for gross receipts. It's including services in the base. It doesn't include the sale of bonds or other evidence of indebtedness or stocks or capital gains or anything from sale of property or stocks. It requires every person engaged in a business then to apply with the Department of Revenue for a seller's permit, and then the tax is required to be collected by the retailer. And then there's a whole list there, and we'll go into more detail on these kind of bills in the future, but it has lists all the different exemptions then to the sales and use tax. It also authorizes the Department of Revenue then to administer and enforce the sales and use tax. It outlines the procedures for making estimated sales tax revenue payments to the Department of Revenue and the penalties for failure to remit or deficiencies in the assessment of the sales tax. Establishes a warrant for the collection of the sales tax. Provides sales and use tax auditing authority to the Department of Revenue. It allows the new general sales tax to be in addition to any other taxes that are imposed by the state or any county, city, district, or other municipal corporation or public subdivision of the state, but it does prohibit any local retail sales and use tax imposed by any county, city, district, or other municipal corporation or political subdivision of the state. It sets out the conditions in which the Department of Revenue is authorized to enter into the streamlined sales and use tax agreement among states, and so this is written in conjunction with the streamlined sales and use tax recommendation that has been set out by the Multi-State Tax Commission, and it takes effect 91 days after the end of the 2003 legislative session. And just for your own information, you do have, too, also some sales tax revenue estimates there just from different retail sales tax rates because that's the blank in the bill. And as far as the revenue impact from, I've run the ones with the decreasing the bottom two tax rates from 4% to 6%, and roughly in beginning in 2004, it would have, for 2003-05 biennium, a $214 million reduction, 2005-07 biennium, a $337 million reduction, and an 07-09, $380 million reduction. So, and then these are your sales tax rates here, depending on what rate you choose.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Wirth. Welcome back.
Hey, any questions?
Thank you. Just another housekeeping bill.
Just another housekeeping
bill. Just put that on the consent calendar. Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Wirth, and I'm the state representative from House District 16. Thank you, Elizabeth. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you today in support of House Bill 3495. First, I want to just talk about, this is going to be long. I'm just going to go on and on and on. But this we'll do it quickly.
Okay.
I'll do it. It'll be long, but quickly. Now, first of all, you know.
The short version of the long.
It's succinct.
Yeah.
Many dismiss the plausibility, obviously, of a sales tax ever being adopted in this state because the sales tax has been rejected 9 separate times. But there's 2 important points to remember about this perspective. First of all, it's important to remember that although a sales tax has indeed failed 9 times, Measure 5, the infamous property tax limitation measure, also failed 5 times prior to its adoption. And then in 1990, on its 6th attempt, passed only narrowly with 52% of the vote. Second, the past sales tax proposals did not differ greatly from each other. The bill before you today, House Bill 3495, is unlike any other sales tax proposal up to this point in Oregon. First of all, I'll go over some quick similarities. Like Elizabeth said, it's a modified sales tax with exemptions of various essential services and goods in recognition of the regressivity of the sales tax. There's also the income tax credit, which reduces the regressivity. And another component is it dedicates one cent of the sale to the county in which the sale took place. You'll notice, however, that there are several specifics in House Bill 3495 that have been intentionally left undefined, specifically the percentage of the sales tax and consequently the amount of revenue the proposal before you can be expected to generate has not been set in the bill. Quite frankly, these specifics are less important than the overall sales tax concept I'm proposing in this bill. And I don't want these details at this point, which can be defined later in the process, to kill the bill right now. So that's for those reasons I've left them blank. For the record, however, I favor the lowest, most broad-based sales tax that may be applied under the provisions of this bill and result in net revenue. That is, my intent in this proposal is for it not to be revenue neutral, but in fact for it to generate more revenue than the state of Oregon currently has. You'll also notice that the bill before you is an enactment, and that is, I'm griping constantly about the legislature's kind of shirking its budget-making responsibility by referring measures to the voters. So my proposal is for an outright enactment. However, you know, our paranoia, and justifiably so, of the referendum, you know, I firmly believe that we should go ahead and vote on it. And if it is referred, we should embrace the voters, not fear them, and stand up and defend the deliberative process that this bill is about to go through. And the referendum, we have to remember, was meant to ensure a public vote on the legislature's decisions. And what I feel it's now turned into is we use the referendum as an excuse to preclude us from making any decisions at all, saying, well, we can't really vote on a sales tax because it'll get referred. Therefore, instead of 2 votes, our vote and the public vote, there's no vote at all. So, but in case of a referendum, certainly, it's justifiable given our history. The components that are unique to this proposal is what I submit makes this sales tax one that voters will support if and when referred to them. Measures on the ballot dealing with state taxing and spending measures is what this all has to do with it. My proposal is based on a great deal of research done in the past 20 years regarding state taxing and state spending measures in Oregon and Washington in particular, and particularly the determinants of public support of such measures by Oregonians in Washington and Washingtonians. While there's generally strong support in both states by the public of state services and agencies, there are important factors that determine or predict support or opposition of taxation issues at the ballot box. Voters clearly realize that the public services they enjoy are the product of the taxes they pay, but they will support tax increases to pay for state services at the ballot box only after an assessment that the amount of the benefits received from the government exceeds the level of the amount of taxes they're asking to be paid for these benefits. When the perceived benefits of a state tax increase are uncertain or are less than the perceived costs, state tax ballot measures fail in Oregon and Washington every single time. What this means in real language and what the research shows about the support and opposition by Oregonians and Washingtonians of state taxing and spending measures is this. In poll after poll, voters in the Northwest tend to view human services, and in particular welfare, as containing significant waste, fraud, and abuse, and consequently assign a high degree of corresponding uncertainty to ballot measures that dedicate funding to human services, hence ballot measure 28. That is, state tax measures that seek to fund human services are consistently defeated by voters in both Oregon and Washington. The public services consistently reported, however, over the last 20 years by Oregonians and Washingtonians as those with a high level of certainty that services will be realized for every tax dollar spent are services that fall into the two budget items of public safety and transportation. And consequently, what we've seen over the past couple of decades in both Oregon and Washington are while tax measures on the ballot that fund human services typically fail, tax measures that fund public safety and or transportation are measures that voters will vote for, and those that fund transportation and public safety either at the local level or state level. And if you think about that in your own past histories, in your counties or cities, consistently over and over, people see for every dollar they spend in taxes a tangible benefit realized when it comes to transportation and public safety. So, succinctly to wrap it all up, here's the crux of my proposal. In all the 9 times we have attempted a sales tax in the state of Oregon, the only time these proposals dedicated their revenue, they dedicated the sales tax revenue to education. And I believe that in this state in particular, we have equated human services with education, with the whole ballot measure 5 and everything. And especially since 1995, up till that point, voters always thought it was human services was the biggest part of the budget. Now they consistently report education. So I think that we can expect voters to be voting the same way or acting the same way in regards to human services as education in this state. And that's why I don't believe the sales tax proposal has ever been embraced by the public up to this point. We have never, however, dedicated the sales tax revenue to public transportation or public safety and transportation. And that's what my proposal does. So it takes the dedicated revenue from the sales tax, funds public safety and transportation at a rate that, you know, we've consistently funded them, if not a little bit more, and then frees up that amount, you know, $3 to $4 billion in the general fund to fund human services and education. And therefore, you know, what's the most stable source of funding in the state is income tax proceeds, and that would go to pay for human services and education. So, and I think another big selling point is when we go out and defend this is that we are dropping the income tax levels of the two lowest brackets by 1%, because, you know, Oregonians are very smart. They realize that we pay way too much, and we're, you know, amongst the highest in their tax for New York personal income tax. So if we couple that, and if we drop the cost of that is pretty minimal. I think Lizbeth and I went over, it's no more than $300 million to drop those two income tax brackets by 1%. And then she also handed you out a table that gives different variations of the amount of revenue that would be raised by 1, 2, 3, up to 7% sales tax. So by funding only public safety and transportation, which only, you know, amounts to about $3 billion of the budget general fund right now, we can keep the sales tax at a fairly low and keep it very broad-based level, therefore more palatable to the voters as well. So, consent calendar, ready to go?
Any questions? We didn't set this for possible work session, so we can't do that this morning. Are there questions for Representative Worth? Thank you for that. That was very concise. Representative Verger.
Well, I come from a very generous part of the state. We pass bond measures, and we support the community college in a bigger way than most places in the state. So I'm a little bit eager to know why you would prohibit any local government from raising a tax if the voters approved of it.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that's what we did is we put in the provisions of the modified or the sales tax provisions that have been done at NCSL, and they looked at all the different aspects, components of all the sales tax measures and put in just kind of a boilerplate of different components. So, you know, I really want to hear those specifics that would get it hung up at this point, because I don't think any of those little details are important enough to not go ahead with the bill. So if that is indeed, you know, something that would keep a lot of look, and that's, again, the trade-off was to give a penny to the county where the sale took place.
Right.
So that to fund, because I mean, I'm certainly aware of, you know, our constant precluding local jurisdictions from raising their revenue. We don't want to cut off their revenue streams. So, I mean, I completely realize that, and that's not something I'm completely wedded to.
One quick transportation has such a nexus to whether it's the gas tax or whether it's the title and registration fees, and we have bills coming through. I think people might look away saying, well, I don't want a sales tax that pays for transportation. I'm already doubling my license fee, doubling my title fees, registration, et cetera. So.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I agree. I think that we're a little fee-happy in the state, and that I would be, you know, completely prone to coupling this with a fee reduction. I think that we can't ask Oregonians to increase or, you know, increase existing taxes or take on a new tax without reducing the fees to some great degree in the state. So that would be a prime opportunity to reduce the fees related to those things that are now currently paying for some of the transportation costs in the state. Good question. Thanks.
Well, Representative Scott thinks your proposal is all wet.
You're kidding.
No,
okay,
he poured his coffee all over it.
Actually, the next one.
Well, and I apologize. I had some technical and personal competency difficulties at the home office this morning, so I don't have my testimony read all over it. I'll get those copies to you.
Appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3495. Oh, that was impressive. Representative Vogt, you come on forward. We're ready for you. We got two bills of yours, so we'll open them in succession and allow you to...
Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
If it wasn't for Representative Butler and Representative Merkley, we wouldn't have much to do this year.
And Representative Przanski and Judiciary. Okay, we have, let's open a public hearing on... Do you prefer, do you have a preference, 28?
Whichever.
Mr. Let's go 2806. It's,
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt, but it's clear to me since we last saw Representative Butler at the beginning of this hearing that we still haven't solved the employment problem.
I do not.
That hat's still in his hand.
He's still got to be.
Still, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60, still with a beef. You're absolutely correct.
Do you want Elizabeth to tell us, or do you want to give us the exposition?
She can go ahead, Elizabeth, and I'll agree.
House Bill 2806, it removes the net capital gain from Oregon taxable income of personal or corporate excise taxpayers. It said it also then is going to add the net capital loss back to Oregon taxable income if the net capital loss was taken as a deduction for federal purposes. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2003. It takes effect 91 days after the end of the 2003 session. So I've just given you there in the background the in 2000, basically for full year returns, there were 271,317 returns with capital gains for a total capital gain of $6.21 billion. That's an average capital gain per return of roughly $22,571. And then in 2000, there also were 83,356 tax returns that reported a capital loss for a total loss of $160.8 million, with an average capital loss of $1,930. So overall, with the 354,673 returns in 2000, we basically saw a net capital gain of $5.96 billion in 2000, which corresponds on average to an increase of $16,812 per return. So basically, this is going to be removing that capital gain from the tax base. Capital gains roughly, when you look at the income and, you know, coming up in 2003, about, you know, $219 million, in 2004, $282 million, so about $400 to $500 million of biennium.
Okay. Although I would bet those numbers are down from 2000. That was just about peak of the capital gains bubble, wasn't it?
And Representative Shetterly, these are numbers that are part of the forecast.
Yes, you're right.
So
I'm reflecting on the numbers.
Yeah, you're right.
In the
those numbers are high, but according to DAS forecast.
All right. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Again, Tom Butler from House District 60, and I just have a question, if I may, of Elizabeth. I'm wondering if the figures that you have, the actual amount that's reported on a tax return is only, relative to a loss, is only a maximum of $3,000. Is that what you've calculated, or have you calculated the entire loss?
Well, Representative Butler, these numbers that we have as far as capital gains are net capital gains,
right.
So it would be...
So the maximum amount of capital loss reported on any income tax return was $3,000. So if we knew the magnitude of the amounts of the capital losses that aren't reflected on returns at this particular point, because the magnitude is limited on any, to be reflected on any return of only $3,000, I'm going to guess that if we were able to deduct those capital losses in total, that we would be looking at virtually billions of dollars. My income tax return will come up to a portion of that. So, unfortunately,
yeah.
So I guess, Mr. Chair, representatives, what this bill does is it attempts to remove the vagaries of the capital market from the income tax system in the state of Oregon. I think there's abundant evidence that the manipulations of the capital market, and I use that word to describe really what has happened in the capital markets, unfortunately, that there have been many manipulations of that capital market, and that is not reflective of Oregon's income, and we have an income tax. And if we were to remove all of the capital gains and the capital losses were to be added back to those returns so as to make sure that Oregon taxed only income as opposed to capital gains and capital resources, then what you could do is this commences then the development of an income tax system, which is really an income tax system. It's based upon income. And I have had Elizabeth Schopp also run some numbers for me to find out what it would. First of all, there's a number of returns. The array of returns leaves you, if you sample those returns literally, what you'd end up with is about 20 actual income tax brackets. They would be very small brackets, but folks would have about 20 very small income tax brackets, which would raise the overall Oregon income tax, the tax on income in Oregon, would be raised to about 10.59, nearly 11%, up from the 9% where we are at present. And then you would actually be able to have an income tax system, which was neutral, and this bill does not do that. This bill is a step, and that's all it is. I offer it to you as a step to move you to an actual income tax system as opposed to a capital gains and income tax system. And that's basically what the bill does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
All right. It sounds to me like there may be some question about the revenue impact, or at least the assumption that's built into it.
Mr. Chair, no, it wasn't to question the work that's being done. It was just to demonstrate that in addition to the $3,000 that I'll be able to deduct and other folks are able to deduct, as we remove that deduction from, see, that what that does is that's in effect a net add back to Oregon. We'll remove the ability, my ability, your ability, those of us who have experienced capital losses, we'll lose the capital losses relative to Oregon. Those go away as well as the fact that we have the capital gains as well.
Okay. Very good.
And what you haven't said is that net capital losses carry forward and will be deductible on next year's federal income tax return. If a bill like this were to pass, they would not be deductible from our return.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, absolutely, very well said. That's what this is all about. It totally removes the vagaries of the capital markets out of the tax returns and basically says, folks, we're glad that you paid income taxes through 2003 on your capital gains, but capital gains are no longer part of the income definition in Oregon, and those of you who experienced the capital losses will have effectively lost the right to deduct those in future years as well. Absolutely.
And my commiserations about your being in that boat.
Yeah.
I think I've got pretty good company.
Plenty of questions. Any other questions for Representative Butler? All right. Anybody else here on that bill? We have, again, a little missive from the Revenue Coalition in our files. We'll recognize that for the record. Close the public hearing then on 2806 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3118. I also had Don Schellenberg signed up. Was he going to join you for this?
If he'd like to, Mr. Chair, does have a little handout. But Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Tom Butler from House District 60. Let me just say this with regard to 3118. House Bill 3118 is an attempt to do what many other states already do, and that's to track where the income is coming from, not just by zip code or those kinds of things, but it's to track the income by school district. Now, that's information which could be reported back to us. So you'll hear that there is a small fiscal with regard to House Bill 3118. And what 3118 does, and I'm sorry, I've jumped ahead of Paul here.
That's okay. It seems pretty straightforward.
What 3118 does, it just goes ahead and allows us to, on our income tax returns, wherever our address is or wherever the principal address of the entity is to go ahead and tell where we are earning, what school district within which we are earning that. Now, that doesn't, if I've got a farm operation that spills over between Ontario and Nyssa on the border, and some of us are in one school district and some in another, it's wherever I'm filing my income tax return from. This is an attempt to start the process, and many other states do this, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, already. They know how much income is collected within each school district. And if we could, and we could probably take by zip code right now and come down to within 20 or 30 or 40% in some school districts and maybe a little finer in others. But what this does is it starts to give us the information relative to each school district. And I'm particularly concerned about the urban areas of Oregon versus the metropolitan areas of Oregon, or the metropolitan versus the rural areas of Oregon. I think within the urban area, there's a lot more resources that are being defined and a lot more income that's earned. And I think that we need to know that, because there will always be the discussion of where the income comes from versus who's supporting who. I think this gives us an additional tool to be able to go ahead and define where the resource is actually vesting with regard to the income, and it starts to build the platform of where you will eventually look to provide some long-term funding. Now, this isn't a funding bill. And it does have a fiscal impact, as I started to mention earlier. The fiscal impact is that in next year's programming, the Department of Revenue is going to have to go ahead and build a three-item field in addition to the other information fields that they have on an income tax reporting program within their own system. And then within the Oregon income tax booklets, you're going to have a portion of a page, or a full page if you wish, a portion of a page which will tell you which school district you're in. So if you're reporting from Baker 5J, if you've got Baker City address, then it's 5J. If you've got a outside of Baker and Haines, then you may have a different school district, or that Burns and Hines may have the same school district. But that will then identify for your income tax preparer, or for you, if you don't happen to know which school district you reside in, you'll be able to identify that right with your income tax guidelines themselves for calculating the income tax. And so there is going to be a small fiscal with regard to this, but I believe personally that the Department of Revenue, who we've yet to hear down in Ways and Means, will be able to accommodate this within their resources for the next biennium. And I would encourage your support for passage of 3118 and move it down to fiscal, move it down to Ways and Means, complete with its fiscal, and we'll handle it with regard to the Department of Revenue. But my comments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that this gives us a platform from whence to start to identify, and many other states already calculate and accumulate this information.
Questions for Representative Butler? Deborah, do you have anything from the department on this? Have you looked at a fiscal on this? You've not. Okay. All right. And so I guess, Representative Butler, I guess you touched on it, but then what do we do with this information once we get it? What does it lead us to?
Mr. Chair, excellent question. It doesn't do anything right now except identify exactly from which school districts the total amount of the $8 billion plus dollars that we anticipate in general fund revenues coming from income tax will actually have been generated from. And if we are to actually begin to make some intelligent discussion decisions relative to using income tax as a basis of resource for school funding, This will give us the information which we presently do not accumulate.
Well, this is comparable. This is basically census information, then, is what it amounts to, as much as anything else.
Mr. Chair, collected it really is nice to know, but not necessary to know. However, the decisions that we presently make relative to school funding and income taxes, or income and income taxes, is not really known to us other than by some sort of a census gathering. And as I say, within some school districts, you could be off by 40 or 50%. Others, you might be able to draw that comparative much, much closer if you're in a zip code that would cover two or three different school districts, school areas.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you probably have seen the reports from the Department of Revenue that show income tax by county. I think Elizabeth showed those beginning of the session. And that's the finest level we go to, and that's the department reporting the address, return address from that return. And we do have one of the problems we've seen with that is that it is whoever sent it in. So if you send it to your CPA in Portland and they mail it into the Department of Revenue, then we've got kind of an over-representation in Multnomah County. So there are some flaws in that data, even the high level of aggregation as it is.
So, Mr. Chair, what it does is it begins to drill down within the information resources which we have. It will not be definitive, but it will give us a launching point from which to base our discussions relative to how do you fund education in rural Oregon, metropolitan, and the more urban areas.
Okay. I imagine for some parts of the state, is that a question they'd almost be afraid to answer?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to guess that within our timber and natural resource-based communities where we are so severely hit overall, that's probably something that we really don't want to share with a lot of folks. However, I nonetheless believe that even bad news is important for us to understand and to be able to work from because that gives us a reference point from which to begin.
Okay. Interesting. Anything else? What time are we on the floor today? Is it 10:30 or
10:45?
Okay. Well, with that, then perfect timing. Thank you, Representative Butler. Always good to have you in our committee. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3118, and lo and behold, committee, almost on schedule. We're done.